Welcome back. Today, as you might have read, we're going to talk about the unknown. And I debated calling this pop science. But then there's more to it than just pop science, right? Most of us, we realize after a while that the man has a problem dealing with the unknown. And when you come to that realization, it depends on what you were thinking before you came to that realization as to how deep that concept concerns you. What's interesting about life is that we have to deal with what's really going on most of the time. Even if we tell ourselves a fictional story off to the side to help appease things that we don't understand, when it really comes down to it, whatever world we've crafted, we have to deal with it. So if we allow the whole world to go to a totalitarian, tyrannical world where we've got robots telling us what to do, and that's what we've got to live for, or live with, right, until we change things. If we let freedom reign, this beautiful, everyone has their own destiny, education's gigantic, people don't want for the basics of life, but there still is the necessity to grow, then we can deal with that reality. Neither one of those exist in their purest form, so we're somewhere in the middle. But the interesting thing about the unknown is that prior to engaging society, you wake up in the morning and you look at your ceiling, and if you have even 60 seconds of your life to yourself, the void of the unknown sets in sometimes. Depends on what kind of person you are, but if you're watching this show, I guarantee you're one of those people. And I think it's super healthy. And so, depending on how you are, but even if you're an optimist that we're going to find out things or that you're going to find a nice plateau to put your feelings in, your belief systems in, I should say, there's still that weird uncertainty that feels strange, you know? At the most fundamental level, we have to look in the mirror every day. And that could be a literal translation of what I'm saying, or it could be a metaphorical translation of what I'm saying. But you and me and everyone else, I should have said I probably, but we have to look at what we are somehow, some way. And then the answer comes back, or the realization comes back. I don't know what I am. I don't know what I am. And how bizarre is that? Some people don't think about it. We're going to get into the replacements for uncertainty, which is the point of this entire episode. But as I always try to do, is I try to build up the point of why on earth I would explain anything else in this episode. But think about that. We don't know what we are, yet we are. I think, therefore I am, right? That's taken at its most fundamental level. When you strip everything away, when you strip the science, Kurzweil, you know, you're just a bag of chemicals away, and then you strip away your religion and all their made up reasons and of what we are. There's probably truth to both sides of the situation, right? We know there's scientific properties of the human body that pan out day to day. And then there's religious situations that pan out day to day. And so there's truth in both sides. And people didn't, you know, people aren't trying to deceive us constantly by trying to solve the problem and give us a sort of a perspective to enjoy life. And it's not something that should make us feel horrible. It should just make us feel maybe curious and at most in the negative realm, uneasy. Hopefully not. But think about it. What are we? Like, what are we? went over a bag of chemicals. We know we have the command for the most part of this mortal coil. But how do you explain love? How do you explain a gut feeling? How do you explain deja vu? Something created us. Something holds us together. It may be a something, and it may be a someone, or it may be a mixture of both. Now, isn't it funny that the irony of existence is to not know what you are? I think that's fascinating. And it sort of, by design, builds in sort of a faith-based system. And one might ask, well, does it really matter if we know? What are we going to gain if we know every answer about what we are? Do we get superpowers? Do we get to fly around the world? Do we get to meet God? And I think that might be just the absurdity that can be assessed from the, I don't know, the drive to know. Maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe it simply doesn't matter. Maybe being, not having the answers is sort of the cool thing about how we live our lives. And there's plenty of examples within the paradigm of our existence, which I'm going to review with you. I'm a pretty big fan of the individual Walt Disney and what he did. And I know there's a lot of conspiracies around this guy, but then he can't defend himself, can he? Anybody can say anything they want about that guy. And he's not here to defend himself. So I tend not to believe a bunch of the bullshit about him. Now, was he suckered into a few things? Maybe. Who knows? But the cool thing about Walt was he took our imagination and he engaged it. And he gave us experiences. He didn't just make a theme park or an amusement park. He made a theme park where every amusement park ride had a story attached to it. And any of you who haven't got into the kind of hatred for commercialism will understand the value that Walt brought to the situation. A lot of my friends can't get into Disneyland because they just think it's too childish. My fear for them is, you know, marketing has sort of killed their soul on one level, you know. But the cool thing about it is the unknown factor is huge. When you go to Disneyland or Disney World or any of the Disney parks wherever you exist. But the cool thing is that the unknown is a very important element when you go to a Disney park. And again, this repeats itself in movies and television all the time. We like being surprised, and we like to have experiences that are bigger than life. And the only way that ever really happens is to have an element of the unknown feed the substrate of the experience. What am I talking about? Well, I have been to Disneyland here in Anaheim, the park that Walt actually helped build. I don't know, 500 times, 600 times? With the season pass, you can just go tons of times, right? And I've been here since 1987, and I've definitely always made a regiment to go. One of my favorite rides in the entire park is a ride called Space Mountain. Most of you have probably ridden it, but if you haven't, it's a roller coaster in a gigantic building, sort of a space age looking pyramid. And it's in the dark, and they've got, instead of seeing all the girder work and what have you, you see stars everywhere. And they have projections now on the walls that, make meteorites fly and all this other kind of stuff. It's been very goofy in the past, and they've upgraded several times. And now, during Halloween, they'll make it a scary ride. And during Christmas, sometimes they'll make it sort of a funky ride. They did Red Hot Chili Peppers singing Stevie Wonder's song, Higher Ground. But one time I was on the ride with my kid, my girlfriend at the time, and the ride stopped. And something went wrong. I don't know what happened. Everyone was fine, but they had to stop the ride, and the lights came on. And all of a sudden, you see this gleaming, amazing roller coaster, and probably the cleanest room I've ever seen in my life. You could have made microchips in this room. You could have had the little bunny suit guys coming along with wafers. It was so spick and span in this room. And so that was an odyssey unto itself. But the second that the lights came on, the illusion of the unknown, or the illusion that's fed by the unknown, of how do they pull this off? How is this thing actually constructed? Was gone. Because I could see everything. And it sort of zapped it for you. Now, go wait 6 months and all comes back to you, you know. And I only go like maybe twice a year, tops. Season passes are grand. 2008, the season pass was $365, and that included parking. Now it's over $1,000 for the same exact thing, and it's only 7 years later. But how many times have you watched your favorite show on television? Maybe like a Walking Dead type show where you have zombies, and while you're watching this show, a lot of women have nightmares after they watch Walking Dead. But as soon as you watch the making of Walking Dead and you see how much they had rickety budgets and they did amazing things with almost no money for the first two seasons, and you realize you see the auditions with the extras who are taught how to walk like zombies, and you hear that everyone in the show is either British or Australian, pretty much. So all these Southern Georgia people have these accents. They're, you know, they're either got a British accent or an Aussie accent, which is, I think, fantastic. It's amazing how fast they can erase their accents. But it takes away most of the believable illusion of the zombie because the unknown has been satiated. And you know, I'm always talking about on the show that I believe in reincarnation as a mechanism to keep us from going crazy, from being a life force that lives forever. And I apologize that I talk about that so confidently. I just think it's almost a certainty. I just think that energy can't hide in the universe, and our consciousness is most definitely made out of something bigger than our mortal coils. If Kurzweil had had an experience where he met Walt Disney at Disneyland and he said, "Hey Kurzweil, Bob Gurr's over there, why don't you go say hi?" And he wanders through the park and finds Bob Gurr waiting in line, I think he would go back to his Singularity Project and have a completely different perspective on what the human consciousness is. I've never talked to that guy. I read his books. I never heard him go through a spiritual route. He is seems to be one of these individuals that feels defined by the fact that he has secularly defined a human experience as nothing more than chemicals. Any of you who've had, you know, there's deja vu where you have a feeling that something has happened before. And most brain books that I own say that that's just a minor brain seizure. That the mechanism that takes short-term memories and pushes it to long-term actually completely eats up the 10-minute buffer that you usually have to wait before things go to long-term. And it immediately starts filing short-term into long-term as fast as you're experiencing it. And so you have the chemical reaction of familiarity, but you're not actually really predicting anything. But some of us have beat it by a mile, and we're predicting things that are happening before they happen. Very detailed things. You know, I told a story probably a million years ago where, and I'll move on once I get this out, but I love to pound into people's brains that my own personal experiences, and I can guarantee you at least half of you listening have had your own experience, you know, and I'd love to hear in the comments section, honestly. But I had moved as a little kid from the Midwest to Massachusetts, and I'm unpacking my stuff upstairs, and it's broad daylight. It's this crazy giant home with a big staircase down, and it's an old colonial home, but it's big. They've taken the home and turned it into a duplex, even though the same family owned both sides. But it's like it has two staircases on both sides, and I guess it was the way it was built way back in the day. But this was in Haverhill, Massachusetts, right on the border of New Hampshire and Massachusetts. Anyway, I'm unloading my stuff. The Vietnam buddy I've talked about, that my dad's best friend's wife's downstairs cooking macaroni and cheese. It's just her and myself and her 5-year-old kid who's outside playing with the dog. Now, at the time, I don't know the kids outside. I just got there. I mean, I literally flew in from a jet, was dropped off. And even though I had visited the previous summer, and this is like fall, I visited in the summertime to kind of set everything up, meet the kids, that sort of thing. I didn't know where this kid was, and anyway, so I come down the staircase, and I turn the corner, and I start going towards this kitchen. The kitchen's a fairly big, kind of barny kitchen, and I walk through the door of the kitchen, and I start to black out, and the mother, who's in that last stage of macaroni and cheese, where you put the cheese in, you're mixing it all up, right, she's mixing this up in a bowl, or in a pan, And she asks me the question, would I like some macaroni and cheese? Like, who, what kid doesn't want macaroni and cheese, right? So I predicted that I liked macaroni and cheese. No. I came to the door. I start to black out. Sort of that purple vision when you have a head rush. But I have to say, I didn't have the head rush feeling. The head rush feeling is like you're going to pass out, right? And I didn't really have the pass out feeling, but I had the vision turning purple. And I put my hand on my head. I'm like 11 years old. Put my hand on my head and I kind of lean my head down. And she's like, are you okay? Because she saw me. And I just walked through the door and I'm having this moment. And I point to the kitchen side door of this big kitchen. I said, someone's going to be at that door and they're going to be hurt. And there's a pause. There's a beat in the script. And boom, boom, boom. Big pounding on the door. And her little boy is crying outside. Now, she's in the mid-stir looking at me. This happens. I just predicted it's happening. And she throws the thing down and runs after her kid. And her kid had just been bitten by the dog on his belly. This big beagle dog had just, he must have been pounding on him or something, and the dog just bit his gut and put big old, you know, bite marks in his gut. And he had to be taken to the hospital and got stitches. Now, I didn't go, so I don't even remember what the hell happened after that. I just remember, I was totally disoriented. Now, she has never talked about that to me, and I never approached her about it. But it happened. So how do you tell me a bag of chemicals is pulling that off? You know, again, a sentient bag of chemicals, the whole standard secular atheist view of a mortal coil, doesn't have the ability to reach out into the universe and see information beyond what you are. You know, it's just you live in this bag, whatever your eyes see is all the reality that you take in, and that's it. But once I experienced that at a really young age, and I had some other weird experiences as a kid, you know, I'll give you one more. And, you know, I'm not a tall tale person. I think that, you know, if we're sitting at a campfire and you want me to scare you, I'll do my best, but I'm crappy at telling ghost stories. Even if someone just tells me a ghost story and they go, okay, walk over there and tell it to them, I'm like all screwed up for the first 10 iterations of trying to retell a story. I was a kid and I was about 9, 10 before moving to Massachusetts. And back in the day, you didn't get babysitters for your kids. They just came home, went in your house, and no one's terrified of the universe, right? You know, the universe is, or the internet's created all these psychoses that everyone's a perv. And of course, the internet's made a bunch of pervs. So I guess it's different today. But I would come home from school about 3 o'clock and I had to do my chores. I made a little bit of money. So I was making my bed. In my bedroom, and I hear the sound of one of the old traditional telephones, which has a bell in it. My mother had one of these old 50s phones, like just the sort of receiver, and I think it was like a red phone. It was really weird. Always felt like a White House phone, right? Lipstick red phone. And I hear it drop on the ground, and when you drop one of these phones on the ground, the bell inside would ring a little bit. It has a little stopper in it, so it doesn't ring forever, but just goes brink, you know. And I'm in my bedroom. It's broad daylight. I don't know, 3 to 4 o'clock, somewhere in there. I hear this thing fall on the ground. So I go into my mom's room, and I look, and the phone has fallen on the bed. So it doesn't really have a fall ability because it's inside this headboard, which is like one of those headboards with the two little sliding things on both sides. You can put a bunch of books where your heads are, you know, where you're. So I'm making my bed and I hear the phone drop. So I go into my mom's room and it's fallen onto the mattress. Now, falling onto a mattress would probably not give it enough concussive force to actually ring the bell inside the unit. And it doesn't really have any place to fall. Right? It's sort of just up on a shelf, just a couple inches over the mattress on this headboard, inside the headboard. It wasn't on top. It was inside. So there's no way it would have fallen out anyway, because what's there to fall, you know? But I didn't see how my mom stored the phone, so I thought maybe she put it in some weird position. Maybe she even put it on her pillow, and then it fell off. But still, there wasn't enough really distance to travel to ring the bell inside. And I, even just as a kid, just common knowledge, it was like, yeah, that's really weird. So no big deal. I put it back. I put the top back on. I push it back in. The cord goes back behind the headboard. And I continue making my bed. And then I hear a ding really hard. Just a few seconds later after getting back in my room. And now I'm a little freaked out. I go in the room. And I kid you not, man, this is not a dream. Broad daylight. That phone is now on the floor. The cord that's stuck to the wall and then up through the headboard and down is stretched as far as it possibly can. And the receiver now is pulled as far as it can possibly be away from the phone itself, which is maybe about 4 feet. And it's lipstick red phone, which is just, you know, it's like this devilish looking phone or whatever. No one's in the house. I check the closets and all this stuff. No one's messed around. And there wasn't any footstep sounds or anything like that. And I was in that room fast enough that anybody was playing a game with me, I would have been able to catch him. My mom's bed was totally packed with stuff underneath. There was only about 3 inches underneath the bed anyway, so no one can hide under the bed. There was just no other way in this two-bedroom apartment in Derby, Kansas, that anything was going to happen. So now I'm freaked out. I put the phone on the receiver, and I put it up, and I leave my place. Because I'm like, this is freaky. I'm going to go to my buddies Jeff and Jim, guys who got me smoking as a child. I smoked, and I quit, and then I started these in my 40s. But I bring them in, and I'm telling them, I said, look, this is really strange. There's something in my home, or something's happening where this phone keeps falling off the receiver, right? So we got a bunch of kids. I get maybe like 3 other kids, and we're all coming back to my apartment. Broad daylight still, summertime, really long days. And we go in. No sooner does my friend go in, the biggest kid, and he goes in and he turns around. He is white. And he's got his hand over his mouth, and his eyeballs are gigantic. And he comes out. I mean, just the second we went in, he just looked inside the kitchen, and he comes out and he freaks us out, so we go outside, and he says, the phone in the kitchen's now on the ground, and it's stretched out as far as it can go. And it was one of these wall units, look like a big banana on the wall, you know? And I walk in, and I see it, and it's giving me the little echoing noise, you know, when you keep the phone off the hook for a really long time. So I put it up there, and honestly, I can't remember exactly what we did after that, but we left. We just locked the door, and I didn't come home until my mom came home. I don't know what that is. I've never heard anyone say anything like that. It seems ridiculous. It seems like somebody was in my home, but all my best friends were with me. Like, I found them at their house. So in terms of someone playing a trick on me, they were amazingly quick at moving around the place. And I don't know what you would assume or insinuate that that would be. Would that be a ghost or something? Shit, I don't know. But it really called into the unknown. And of course, everybody wants to solve for the unknown, right? I mention those stories because that one breaks the ice and breaks the seal on what we think we are as human beings. And the other one suggests that I have to live with the unknown for the rest of my life in this weird phone incident. I'm 46 years old talking to you right now, and I will swear on a stack of Bibles or whatever the hell you think is going to get at my soul or a lie detector test. I have no idea how that phone did what it did, but I have those visions burned in my brain, especially the phone on the second fall. In my brain, and it's just disturbing. Why would anyone do that? You know, like a thief is in there. Oh, let me just play a trick and pull the phone out. Like, what? What? Who the hell does that? It's not even funny. I mean, it's just kind of kooky. And I've never experienced anything like that since that I know of, where I thought something moved or something. Never. Just these little one-offs in my life, right? I haven't really had any prediction experiences really beyond that much. I've had, you know, intuition and feeling and. Again, I think people have said, hey, I've died, I'm moving on. But everything I've ever had happen to me is almost a one-off species of unknown. It's sort of, it's known and it's unknown. My grandmother who passed away, I had a vision that morning and she said, I'm on the other side and I'm fine now. I just want you to know. And then my mom calls me, and that's around 12 o'clock in the morning, somewhere in there. Early afternoon, and then my mom calls me at 2:30 in the afternoon and says, Grandma passed last night. I'm like, I know. She said goodbye to me this morning. Everyone has stories like that, too. I mean, like, a bunch of people have stories like that I know. But we blow it off, and we don't think about what it means And so we think we live with more unknowns than I think we really do. But what is the unknown solution, or the solution to the unknown that we deal with every single day? Well, most of us understand the dangers of religion. Right now, this world, right now, is probably in a part fiction, part fact war of religions right now, right? The Islamic State has been pushed up as this terrorist organization that we have to deal with. And now we have massacres happening all over the world, right? And just as of this day of this recording, yesterday evening, the President of the United States, Barack Obama, said that, San Bernardino attacks were a terrorist attack because it was two Islamic people who went in and shot a bunch of people. Okay. So religion is one of the ways that we fill up the gap of the unknown. What is after this life? What is this life? Et cetera, et cetera. Right? All right. When we're not in a crisis situation, either we don't allow it to infect our lives or it's simply not happening in the universe, the other paradigm of existence that we use to fill up the unknown is science. In both categories, and I'm not sure besides deep thoughts and your thoughts that are like deep thoughts, right, that there's a third option. And I hope that the third option becomes everybody's option, which is to do your own self-analysis of the situation. Like I said in a previous episode, I do believe we are born and gifted with several things that we don't understand. One, I think that you and I both have all the wherewithal, as long as we don't impair our minds with drugs or poisons or something, we have the wherewithal at birth to figure everything out to at least a satisfactory degree. Now, we won't have the confirmation from any higher being necessarily to say, that one's correct, that one's not. So you sort of have to build it yourself. But again, we don't think very much in this world anymore, right? Now, the listeners of this show, if you are a masochist and you get to this minute in the day, you are one of those people that are trying to find something deeper in life. And welcome to the club, man. I'm probably joining your club, if anything, right? But you take religion, most of them on planet Earth, and it tries to satiate man's ability to not look at the infinity of the sky and death and birth and suffering and have uncertainty as to why it's occurring. You know, the reality of life is probably something like life is just tough. It just is tough. And that's probably, if you boil down all of the intended lessons of a religion, it's pretty much what they're saying. But they're saying to you, well, it's God's plan. Everything is determined. We live in a deterministic universe. Scientists also come to the same conclusion from a perspective of determinism, that everything mathematically is determined. That we are simply falling through, like the ball in the pachinko game, we're falling through an eventuality. Now, again, there's that third mezzanine that says, well, you might have the ability to choose what second comes next. So it's not all written in stone for your particular journey. You get to choose. Now, the interesting thing about religion is that they say that because we're flawed, we don't get to see God until we make amends with God, pay our penance, get baptized, whatever your religion happens to believe, and then you get a chance to be back with God. Until then, it's an eye for an eye from God's perspective. You do one sin, you can't see me forever because I can't exist with sin. Sin being a very relative state, of course, of being, right? The interesting irony about the whole thing for me with original sin, when you boil it back to its original cause, is that we are flawed. The duality that goes with we are flawed is that if we were perfect, we would have no choice. If we were perfect, we would know everything. There wouldn't be a left and a right, a good and a bad. We'd have all knowledge and we'd be perfect. So the greatest gift that a supreme being could give us, or we could give ourselves if we are the supreme being working together, is being flawed. So original sin is based on something that has to exist if we are to be creatures with choice. It has to be this way. Otherwise, we're just robots. We're Q continuum people that never die. We know everything. We've had every single conversation you could ever have with every being. We've been every being. We've been every location. We just are a gestalt of is. And I don't think anyone in their right sentient consciousness would ever want such a thing for themselves. But if you buy into a religion, the interesting thing is that once that that maybe uneasiness you have with any level of unknown is satiated by even a fictional story that's completely false, it allows you to get back to what's actually going on in the now in your life. Now, some of us have suspected that if we could get a better grasp on the universe and where we come from and what our purpose is, quote unquote, that we would live in the now much more efficiently and much more congruent with what the universe wants out of us. A lot of us assume that we exist for a purpose, that we're not just, bits in a computer being read into a slot machine in Vegas where all the wins are predetermined, you know, which is the way it works. We like to think that we have choice, that we can maybe surprise God or surprise other beings in the universe with our ingenuity and our creativity. I certainly hope there's an element of that for all of us, you know? If nothing else, you're hanging out with your friends and you just happen to synthesize up a joke and it made everyone laugh, because a joke is when you bring two concepts that are normally contradictory together and the mind can't deal with it and you laugh. That's how it happens. That's what a joke is. I'm hoping that I've made some spirits laugh. I hope if there's a God, I've made him laugh several times. If not at my expense, you know, with me, you know. When it comes to science, you know, there's this thing that bothers me called pop science. And pop science is usually a theory that is completely baseless. It almost entirely contradicts what we actually observe in the universe, what we observe on paper with the physics and the mathematics that we figured out. But we accept it because it satiates the unknown at a level that is almost utter certainty if you buy into the paradigm of various science institutions and egos that have been pushed up into the consciousness of man, right? We like to just say Albert Einstein was a genius, whatever he says is right. Stephen W. Hawking's a genius, whatever he says is right. Neil deGrasse Tyson's a genius, and everything he says is correct. But every single decade in the past, we've always thrown away a lot of what we had discovered before, and we find new, better theories. And this was the mantra of most educational institutions up until the internet existed. And, of course, people who watch this show and people who explore the universe like crazy, they know that we are the ones that are now uncovering things. The novice has now become the expert. You know, we don't need to convince a panel of doctoral review panel individuals at a college that we have come up with an interesting theory, we've thought it all through, we've done all the mathematics, whatever we need to do, and we have a hypothesis at the end of our thesis that has been proven, disproven, whatever. We don't need that accolade anymore to feel like we are actually intelligent human beings. Because now, through the internet, through all this cross-referencing of who has been given an accolade for something that was completely wrong, we now know that that's a process that is institutionalized. Stephen W. Hawking's PhD thesis, his first one, was on the Big Bang. And Cambridge University, who is a very prestigious organization where Isaac Newton held the position that Stephen Hawking holds today, they have a requirement within the charter of their college institution to reveal secrets about the universe. It's their charter to have students pioneer the understanding of everything in every category that they teach, not just cosmology. But we now know that Stephen W. Hawking was given a PhD credit, accolade, forever status, degree, for something that is completely untrue. Isn't that interesting? It'd be like me trying, you know, writing a paper about how ice cream has bones in it. But because it was a really popular question, perhaps I was answering. The PhD board gives me the degree. They pass my grade. I get a PhD. I become a doctor in the eyes of the world in this one discipline of ice cream anatomy, right? And later on, someone digs in the ice cream and goes, there's no bones in here. What the hell are you talking about? It's like, huh? But my degree does not get rescinded, even though everything that I suggested, even though it might have been clever and interesting and mathematically worked out on paper and biologically worked out on paper, the anthropology of my ice cream study was completely incorrect. I still get to keep my degree. And as long as I think of another theory that is, again, unprovable, and cosmology is amazing because you can basically imagineer your own degree. And that's what Stephen Hawking did, was he imagineered something out of nothing. Literally, the Big Bang. There's nothing and then there's something. And all life spawned from this thing. And no one did the most fundamental due diligence on what a Big Bang would actually be as an entity of energy in the universe and how it would have actually exploded and how it would have uniformly distributed all matter in equal portions all over the universe. And life would have never existed had that thing ever existed and been especially our inceptional moment of creation. It's a ludicrous fail in the first day of analysis theory. But they didn't have Stephen Wolfram's algorithms to prove that life doesn't exist with even distribution of energy. So why wouldn't you take away his degree? Why wouldn't you say you need a degree in something else that actually works out? It's a ludicrous assertion I'm making, but I'm just making it because accolades are given out every single day to satiate the unknown, and we look the other way. We don't even pay attention. But then these individuals, through the power of an institution that needs sort of an accolade, a credibility, such that parents will send their children there to get money to keep a bunch of older guys who also had bunk theories that fed their PhDs in some cases, right? Keep going. This is how we validate information into our world so that we feel like we actually have a grasp of the universe. So what's the inverse idea? I'm telling you that some of these degrees are ridiculous. All right. Let's say you don't necessarily agree with that, but let's look at the inverse. What will we do if we didn't do that? What if I say, wouldn't it be nice if you got rid of all the religions on the world and treated God like an omnipotent creature of which his or her intelligence is so vast and so amazing and so infinite in every dimension of measurable reality that you can't possibly understand what that God is doing, how that God exists second to second, etc., etc. I don't think that's actually true, but let's just say that's what it was. And science, well, we say, look, we're going to study as much as we possibly can, and perhaps we give away degrees and PhDs under the pretense that this was at least one avenue that we explored that wasn't true. Maybe you give Stephen Hawking a PhD degree, not because his Big Bang Theory is true, but because he had the creativity in his mind to exhaust the idea of a Big Bang not being true. Why wouldn't that have the same amount of value as saying it is true? But the one thing we'd never teach each other, and it's because I think we are genuinely frustrated with the unknown, is teaching the unknown. What parent intentionally teaches the unknown and has a regimented curriculum to teach the unknown? I've never met anyone who formally teaches the unknown. How would you even do such a thing? I'm going to suggest a few techniques in this episode. I like the title, General Relativity, because I think general relativity is such a beautifully abstract metaphorical concept, those two words together, that you can apply it to generally every aspect of your life. Life is a relative experience, and what you're trying to do in this world is relative. Let's say that for whatever reason, I woke up one day and I had the Ethernet cable of the universe plugged directly in the back of my head, like Matrix. And any question I ask that Ethernet pipe, it comes back with a beautiful, simple, one-sentence answer, and that answer is 100% correct. And I ask it very quickly, While the connection's live and humming, what's the answer to life, the universe, and everything? Of course, it comes back 42, and then I ask what 42 means. And it says, how many paths must a man walk down? The idea is, if I told you the answer to anything, and it was the absolute answer to some of this most unknown stuff, I don't know that it would affect or satiate your suspicion of the unknown and your uneasiness with the unknown. You might always debate the answer, even though it might be completely true. But in the end, what we have to do is live this life. And yeah, I'm not saying this is easy, and I'm not saying that we should not ask the questions and continue to try to solve all these avenues that I'm talking about. But I think it might be interesting to approach it as perhaps science of the unknown, or maybe the degree is called unknown sciences, or the category of education is called unknown sciences. What are you majoring in? I'm majoring in unknown sciences, or maybe just the unknown. And then everyone who listens to you goes, oh, interesting. And hopefully, if we were to categorize the unknown and call it the unknown, then the context, the relative context of everything we put inside that discipline in college, or whatever curriculum we're putting together, has a beautiful encapsulation that allows us to pull out of the study, live our life, live in the now. We got to raise our kids. We got to raise ourselves. We got to have a relationship with someone if that's what we want. Find our destiny within what we have as our paradigm of existence, a mortal coil, a planet, an atmosphere, politics, you know, maybe not religion, because religion is trying to solve for the unknown. Politics is how we have to build a society and get along, right? But perhaps we stay more focused if we could just simply say and acknowledge to each other that science has a bigger category of actual function, right? We're trying to develop science to make computers better, to make medicine better, et cetera, things we need in the now. And then you have theoretical sciences, which is really where the unknown category exists, right? Where we go and try to fill up gaps that are infinitely expansive, right? Totally vast, infinite buckets of unknown. Religion would be a science of the unknown, trying to determine if we have a creator, if there's some sort of spiritual consciousness that has a purpose, us, you know. Is there a charter for man? Are we just a bunch of bacteria crawling on a ball, dying and going into some really spherical, you know, heliocentric or flat earth petri dish? But by not, in my opinion, by not positioning it in that realm of thought, we never really progress at the right perspective of all of it. And when we communicate it outward, we communicate it when we don't have the perspective of trying to solve for the unknown. In my opinion, when things like Big Bang are taught, they're taught as a certainty, and they're not taught as a potential dead end and an explanation to solve for the unknown of at least how this universe, the mass and matter and electricity that we deal with second to second, may have come into existence. Now, there's a hidden danger in trying to fill up the unknown. And I was going to call this episode Pop Science, but the problem with calling it Pop Science is that there's a religious element to it as well. And there's probably other categories I'm missing, but the unknown is like pushing the jaws of life into your consciousness. And when you pull it open and you can see the unknown, the aperture of your eyeball that sees the unknown, the aperture of your consciousness that can see the unknown, is held open by the unknown. It keeps your mind open for all concepts, all possibilities of truth. You know, we don't need to necessarily call out the lies, because there's not necessarily lies. There just simply are untruths and truths. But you're not going to get at a truth until maybe you've exhausted a couple untruths. And we have to use logic and common sense, maybe scientific method in some cases, to determine which one we're looking at. When a child is taught things that satiate the unknown, those jaws of life in that particular area of the unknown are closed and removed. And it becomes a closed paradigm of thought. And I could actually hear elders saying that's better for mankind to close their minds and get on with their life than to spend their time in this existential research branch of their consciousness, never dealing with now. You know, there's the famous movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, 1978. Richard Dreyfuss is a guy that sees a flying saucer, a couple of them. And his face gets burned by looking up out of his electricity truck because he's an electrician, and he gets his face burned, and he comes home and he's trying to tell his wife all about it. And she's sort of like your average ditzy wife, beautifully played by Goldie Hawn, I believe. And actually, I have that name wrong. I apologize. But I think I got that name wrong. But he ignores his children after a while because this thing gets so intense in his mind and no one's believing him, and he's trying to solve for that unknown. What is that thing I just saw? And the Air Force is acting funny, and there's this, you know, Devil Mountain has a toxic spill, and that seems to be the place where these notes that are being played have a GPS coordinate system over Devil Mountain, and he goes there and he bumps into another woman who's lost her child. But these people lose their entire lives to this unknown research. And because it was so close to them, because these UFOs were seemingly communicating with them, inviting them to see what they had to see, they felt like this was my charter in life. So they needed to solve for that so intensely that Richard left his family and got on a plane, got on a flying saucer and left. You know, and one of the mothers who he made friends with, who lost her child, actually got her child back out of a UFO, and she just was like, I'm just going to raise my kid and we're going to get rid of this story, right? When I think I told the story, I was going to that church with the pedophile, which I didn't know. And I was trying to solve for the proof of Jesus Christ, because he kept telling me this guy exists and there's proof that he existed. And when I started researching and researching it, there was nothing. And eventually, I was always in the youth group, because I was about 18, 19 years old at the time, and I was the older kid inside this youth group. And I was just, you know, it was a good group of people, and I got lured in again to see a music studio, and that's where it took off. But there were elder courses for the adults where they had this study. So you go to church service and then you did like two to three different studies throughout the week. All right. At one point, the elders brought me in the room, and these guys are PhD professors at Pepperdine University. Some of them are in psychology, some of them religion. And they said, well, you know, we've been told by the youth minister that you keep bringing up the proof of Christ in this youth group. And they said, essentially said in so many words, we want you to stop asking that question in front of all the kids. Mainly because they had invested years and years in indoctrinating these children into believing this ridiculous story, which has its benefits, but still it was satiating this unknown in these kids. And he said, there is no proof of Jesus Christ. There is none. Everything you've ever been told that actually is proof, the Shroud of Turin, however they say it, the idea that someone recorded that Jesus of Nazareth was actually crucified at his time, none of that exists. It doesn't exist anywhere. And if you've ever been told otherwise, you've been lied to. Believe me, I've gone down this path twice, and in multi-year research projects for books I was writing, and then just my plain morbid curiosity. There is no proof. Now, I'm not trying to get into a debate about if he exists or not, but these guys pulled me aside. They said, you'll never find the proof, but we think, as the elders of society, that it is better for man to fill this unknown with his belief in Christ and become people, better people, by following his teachings, than to have a rule, you know, the law of the jungle create a chaotic planet where no one has any morals and it's the survival of the fittest, which is what it used to be before religion really kind of straightened everything out. Not just Christianity, but all the religions before that, right? And it was a very eye-opening experience. I think I was 19, 20 years old when I had this conversation. And that had a profound effect on me because it took me decades to really understand the validity and the value of what they were saying. Now, they were very upfront about it because they, again, had invested, and they had invested tons of, well, basically every hour that their child was born, indoctrinating them into this belief system, which now genetically they'll never be able to completely vacate those theories out of their mind. Right? I'll be honest with you. I don't think Jesus ever existed, and I can tell you that, but I would be lying to you if something deep inside me genetically still had a problem with completely feeling a cool sensation in my heart that he never existed. Because I've been so indoctrinated from birth that that guy existed and then I should feel guilty and I might not go to heaven or whatever. Now, I don't believe any of that as a conscious adult, but somewhere deep down inside me is still that little kernel going, but maybe, but maybe. But the second I pull my head out of my ass and think it through, I'm like, oh, it's ridiculous, right? Good intentions, right? And there's a lot of beautiful lessons within his story, but I don't need to believe this stuff. It's weird how that works, right? Now, science never really gets into the dispute like these old men say. Well, it's better that people believe in a Big Bang than, I guess, I don't know what, robbing grocery stores and raping people. It's not what happens. Religion might be able to make that argument, that if we don't have the fiber and the moral fiber and sort of social etiquette with each other, that we're going to turn into these crazies. That's probably more close to the truth. But no one's going to lose their mind if they don't know if black holes are real. Or if dark matter is a complete button on the end of the Big Bang, because the Big Bang never happens, so they have to create dark matter to kind of button up all the physics of the missing matter and blah, 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 right? But the most dangerous thing about it is closing the minds of kids. We want this world to be a better place. Okay. Well, how do you fix the world? Well, someone's going to have to think. And they're going to have to think, that old cliche, you're going to have to think outside the box of what we're doing right now to create the change that we want. And then we get that little kickback, that little sort of self-deluded theory that if everyone just believed what I believe, because I'm having a good time, I'm totally relaxed and chill, and I believe I'm centered. If everybody just believed exactly what I believe, as wrong or right as it might be, well, at least you'd be as chill as me. And we'd all be chill. We'd all be relaxed and cool. Some of you would like to smoke cigars and some of you wouldn't, but you would be chill and you'd be relaxed. And so we think, well, I just need to get everyone to believe what I believe, and then boom, it's going to be okay. Obviously, that's not true either. But people get drunk on that concept. You know, how many Christians in the world right now, okay, even if you're just a light Christian, you were a Christian and you don't go to church anymore, but how many people believe that if we could just get all these violent Muslims who are Islamic fundamentalists, Islamic jihadists, right? If we could just get them to believe our version of Christianity, well, then what they do in their infidel passages, which are only in 4% of the Qurans in the world, probably growing more now, but they would pull out of this idea that they need to kill everyone to solve their problems. That's not exactly what they think. They're trying to get rid of our troops out of their countries, and they feel like terrorism would be the only way to pull that off. Some of them are shills, and some of them are reacting to the shills, and they're being duped to think that these things are real, and they're willing to do the same stuff. And they're probably just sick and tired of having their homes bombed. Wouldn't we, right? But we're living, if you can hear me, you're most likely living in a first world country where the education is at least available to the extent that your brain can process the information. If you live in a first world country, you're allowed to probably have some modicum of freedom of speech, the Magna Carta rights of Europe or the Constitution of the United States. Same thing, right? We got ours from them. Okay. So there's really nothing holding us back besides indoctrination. Besides, aside from someone filling up our unknown with the information of a possible truth, without the qualifying bit on there that it's a maybe and not a certainty. And you hear me talking on this show constantly about, hey, don't teach your kids everything as a buttoned up truth in every area. Right? I think some things are like that, you know? I don't think that some things that were taught actually work. For instance, sorry, I'm looking at a bunch of chemtrails being sprayed overhead. I think that, you know, theories like treat others as you would want to be treated yourself, the illusion of that statement is that it's actually going to happen to you, right? If you actually give to people, people are going to give back to you. Even people that you love and live with, you might think, well, hey, it's just going to boil, you know, maybe I meet a taker, right? And she comes into my home and we live together, we date a lot. And if I just give to her a lot, eventually she'll understand that she's taking a lot. And she might assume, well, if I rub her feet, maybe I like mine rubbed too. Maybe her thing is her feet and her thighs because she works out at the gym, and I like my shoulders rubbed and my head rubbed. You know, who knows, right? But someone should be asking the question back. But you guess what? You know, most of you have lived any number of years, you know that doesn't happen. There's no automatic association until we communicate with someone that we need these things too. And obviously, my piece of advice to you after failing miserably in my lifetime with this sort of regimen is that before you engage in a commitment with someone, before you even get anywhere down the line, you would need to bring that up to someone. And that's what I do today. You know, I tell a girlfriend, look, here's the thing. I've dated three takers in a row and I'm sick and tired of that formula. And I love those people and they're good people. They mean well, but they just don't see life from an empathetic lens. They see it from a taking lens. They're so desperate and scared of the universe that it's like they want to hoard every quality of human beings and objects out of the universe that they can to make sure they don't slip, but they have a reserve, they have a service that's at their beck and call to get what they need out of life. You have to say that, and then you'll maybe find someone who goes, well, hey, you know, I'm a nurse. I'm a giver. I know what empathy is because I live in that fabric of my existence every single day. So we're going to do just fine. I'm like, okay, that sounds good to me. Let's roll. But we have a, and most of our listeners know this because we post this on our site and our listeners that I'm friends with post this on their pages. We have a dangerous thing going on that we have. Everyone knows that we have hero worship and celebrity worship in our world right now. It's sickening, right? People that are morally repulsive, even if you have liberal views in the world, are some of the most famous people on this planet. And the way I always try to shake someone's brain up a little bit about who they worship is to say, what if your son became that guy? What if your daughter became that woman that you're worshiping, that you're going to TMZ every day, you're buying People magazine, the Inquirer, whatever, or you just secretly look over at the grocery store, right? I said, what if your daughter became Kim Kardashian? She made a porn or several porns to get herself famous. Maybe she didn't intend to, but that's what happened. And do you really want your daughter to do that? Is that what you're raising your kid to do? Again, it you could say, well, it worked out for her. Man, she's rich now. Blah, blah, blah. Seriously, if that's how far your brain went in its development and you're rich, what's the point of money, right? But we need to apply the same theory to some of the more glorified individuals in the world that fill up these two buckets of the unknown, the religious unknown bucket and the scientific unknown bucket. Because I think you might look at these people a little bit differently. You don't have to hate them. You don't have to wish them any harm. But it might be that you curb, okay, your recommendation to your own life and who you glorify in your life, right? In the God episode, I mentioned the Pope. And obviously some Christians are going to get really upset about this, but the Pope presides over an organization that on paper, okay, has presided over the largest pedophilia organization on planet Earth's history. We don't have a second organization on this planet in all recorded world history that has molested more children than the Catholic Church and its empire from the Vatican. It goes on every day. And you might say, well, you know, it's just a few bad fathers and, you know, you can't blame the whole organization for a couple people. Well, maybe that's true, but those guys never go to jail. They were pushed around during the 80s and 90s when hundreds, if not thousands of kids were being molested. One guy usually is responsible for about 500 kids about the time he gets caught, just like the parliament in England, right? We got them here in the United States too, but they managed to cover their tracks a little bit better here. So what do you do with that organization? They're also on paper having laundered the world war chest from the Nazis. So the Nazis stole all this stuff from people in Europe. And because they all got, you know, most of these Nazis, including Hitler, they all escaped. Okay, we pretty much know this now. They all went to, the ones that were really hot went down to South America and died down there. And most of the ones that were scientists went into the United States and became either the CIA or NASA. Wernher von Braun, remember, he made the Saturn V rocket that supposedly got us to the moon. Well, he made V1 and V2 rockets that killed the living crap out of Europeans. It's British people, right? Especially British people. All right. They did that. They laundered the money, probably took a huge profit for themselves, and they got to keep the treasures, and they simply paid these guys out with whatever other funds they were maybe capturing during the, was it the talent, giving the 10% from their people. Take a painting of the Mona Lisa caliber, and he estimated its value maybe $10 million, maybe estimated it priceless, and whoever got it gets a little bit of money. But those organization, that organization continues to exist with the guy at the top called the Pope. And people are trying to use this evil, evil, evil organization as a proxy to God. You're asking the guy who runs the joint how to get to God when he presides over probably the most Luciferian organization on planet Earth. Even if you're a scientist, we can still use those words to describe their deeds. Even if you're secular and you're atheist, you can still use those words to describe those deeds, right? Science side, a little less touchy-feely, right? But we have, again, scientists who have been revered as being completely correct. And they're being pushed up into the consciousness of mankind right now. And all they do is run around repeating science that has been proven wrong by your edgiest thinkers, okay? And we're promoting them as the authority to figure out how the universe works or how what threats were facing with perhaps climate change or something, right? Now, what's interesting about it is that if you studied science at any point in your life, you read a book about a scientist, and the scientist was something several hundred years ago, and, you know, Copernicus and Newton and, you know, everyone, let's put it that way, Einstein, Oppenheimer, all these guys had taken the previous dude's science and stepped on their shoulders and moved it up and moved it up and moved it up, increased our thinking, and did discover a few things that have helped us out. But a large amount of everything that they discovered has been proven wrong. But it still ebbed us in the right direction to find out what was right. And we don't have any problem with Isaac Newton's, you know, particle theory of light being deprecated for a wave theory of light. We don't think Isaac Newton is all of a sudden a dumb guy because he got that particular observation incorrect with the materials and the machinery that he had at his disposal, right? But today, if you were to question anyone that is existing today that's up on the stage talking, you're sort of a jerk. No one really goes to that effort to say that you're a jerk, but if you reply to a video of someone giving a speech, especially someone talking about Big Bang or something, you simply throw out some lucidity in there. I'm not really talking from experience, but I'm sure it would happen. Someone's going to get violently angry with you about your observation. When we talked about in episode 26 that we didn't go to the moon, you know, I've got, I don't know, there's like 14 comments in there. I think only one guy posted sort of a, I should go back to smoking crack. I love it, right? The funny thing was, I thought the guy made the comment randomly, and I didn't realize when I re-listened to the episode, I said that I was a space kid on crack, is what I said towards the beginning of the episode. And it was actually a brilliant joke of saying, you should go back to smoking the crack. It's hilarious for me, right? So what I find is that we have to have so many years go by, maybe even centuries or half centuries go by, before we're willing to ask the questions in the common lexicon and the common teaching process of mankind whether or not what we're being taught today is actually correct or not. And so these unknowns are filled up and the minds are closed in children. You know, there's, I'll just rattle through some very quickly, and I won't necessarily beat them up to an extent, so you don't have to listen to all my details again, because you've all heard how I beat up the Big Bang if you listen to the episode. But we pretty much know the Big Bang doesn't exist because it would have distributed the energy of the universe evenly, and nothing can exist in even distribution. Life patterns don't evolve out of that such a thing, right? Let's look the other way when the physics doesn't work, you know, when matter can't actually be condensed down to a singularity. The scientists go into a religious doctrine to say, well, you just have faith that we're going to discover the mathematics that makes this weird theory possible, when its creator no longer really pimps it as much as we think he does, right? We have Albert Einstein's E=mc². You know, it's the theory that energy could not disappear; it can only be transformed into different forms of energy. That is completely correct. But if you do his theory and you put in the speed of light and you try to move a particle to the speed of light, there's a divisible by zero problem with the algorithm, and they say C=mc² proves that nothing can go the speed of light, because you have to have the entire universe push a particle, and because the particle is not pushing itself, you're missing at least the last, you know, pounds per square inch to get it to go the speed of light. Well, Eric Dollard himself in the 80s has videos in a basement club of his where he proves right in front of your face that he got electrons to move faster than the speed of light, right in front of your face. Not a big deal. Accelerators can do it, you know? So those theories don't work. But what does that do? You know, one, we don't try to figure out how the universe started, and it's probably not important that we actually figure it out, but whatever. Again, under the guise of an unknown science, like a theoretical science realm of education, I like to say unknown, because then we can bring religion in. We can bring everything into a more generic container, right? There's unknown things about botany, anthropology. I mean, there's unknowns of everything, right? Theoretical sciences should be absolutely everything, but the word science is attached to it tends to knock a bunch of other things out. But if we don't think we can go to the speed of light, how does that sanction the mind of man? We can no longer leave this planet and really go anywhere, because if we're sublight, it's going to take too long to get there. Well, you know, luckily there's scientists. I saw a great presentation probably 10 years ago at Cornell University about some guys that really have figured out how they can slingshot the velocity of energy to get way over the speed of light quickly. Very cool, right? But they don't get any airplay, because we haven't had enough decades past the current blowhards to give these kids any eye shot of what they're talking about. And what are they going to have to be, 50, 60 years old before we listen to them because the other guys are dead? It's absurd that we don't live in a more fluid society where the unknown can be approached in a much more benign, friendly manner, right? We have this climate change thing going on, which used to be global warming. Well, you got a problem, guys. For anybody who wants to yell at someone for being a climate denier, all right, well, I'll throw you the science and you tell me how it works. The atmosphere is 99.9%, carry the nine very far, water. The amount of CO2 in the greenhouse gas layer is 0.054%. That's 1/540th of a single percent of all the materials that make us warm is CO2. And that's everything. Volcanoes, rotting, you know, mass in the ocean, cal farts, everything. Man doesn't contribute, but maybe 2.5% of the 1/540th of a percent. That's so tiny that if you wanted to show it to yourself, you take a penny, the smallest increment of your money, and cut it into a pie slice that's 540th of a pie slice. And then from that infinitesimal, almost non-visible slice of a penny, take out 2.5%. Even if you go with Al Gore's crazy theory of 12.5%, which contradicts all the scientists that founded this group, who sued to get their names out of the group, the head meteorologist of MIT, a patent-holding meteorologist at NASA, and four other guys that were utter authorities on it, they said this is ridiculous. There's virtually no CO2 in the greenhouse gas layer, which is the index of chemicals that make us warm. There is no other index. There is no other layer of atmosphere that makes us warm. So how are we deniers? Simply by looking at the most basic piece of information, which is how much CO2 in the atmosphere is responsible for heating us. Nothing. There's more oxygen on the surface of the sun, okay, than is CO2 in the greenhouse gas layer. But you see how teaching bunk science, and agenda-based science especially, closes the minds of all of us, so we can't deliberate the truth. I just think it's something has to give here, right? Something has to give where we can re-engage reality in a comfortable manner, where we actually teach first the unknown, and then we're okay with the unknown not existing. We don't have to come up with the Michelangelo guy with the white beard touching, you know, Adam's hand with his finger to be okay with still believing that there might be something from something creation algorithm to the universe. We just simply don't know. But the unknown hurts, right? The unknown is the thorn in our sides, as Paul wrote in the New Testament. What's actually the irony of me saying that is that Paul never said what the thorn in his side was. You know, he had a thorn in his side. We don't know what it was. Something was gnawing at him. Maybe he liked men. Who knows, right? I actually had a preacher tell me that. We think he might have been a homosexual. Whoa, where on earth did you get that? Are you projecting, dude? Like, what's the deal? But maybe if you're a parent of a newborn, or you have access to someone who's deliberating how to raise that newborn, maybe you can bring up this conversation with them. Because I think we can create a new species on planet Earth that is far more mentally prepared for reality than we are. Because if you can hear me, unless you had a very special set of parents, and I certainly didn't have any, I mean, I had a special pair of parents, but I mean, they, in this category of education, I didn't, of course. No, I don't think anyone did. What if you taught a child to be comfortable with the unknown from the get-go? And we tell them, look, most of the universe and our life is unknown. We're doing our best as human beings to fill it up with potential theories. But just know that anytime you try to solve for the unknown, there's a greater likelihood that we're not going to completely nail it. And that's okay, too. Again, you could give Stephen Hawking a PhD for the Big Bang Theory, but not because it's true, but because he had the wherewithal and the creativity to go down that path and simply prove this particular idea could never have been true. And again, to his defense, he didn't have a lot of the post-research that's occurred since he came up with the idea. So hats off to the dude for being creative, right? But unlike Isaac Newton, who held his position before he had it at Cambridge, we deprecate Isaac Newton's knowledge in some areas, right? He discovered calculus, let's put it that way. That's still true. But his idea about the universe just wasn't right. Okay, now we have one check down. That didn't happen. Well, let's try to figure out what did happen, maybe, if we care. I know you feel me. I'm hitting this from as many angles as I possibly can because there's different people listening out there, and you have potentially a bucket of knowledge that addresses one of these areas of the unknown, and you're trying to figure out how to maybe restart your furnace to go research it, maybe a different tense. Maybe you're on the cusp of something, but it's not really working out. And you think, well, if I've put 10 years of research or more into this particular subject to solve an unknown and it's not working out, then I feel like a failure. I'm not going to get my PhD if I can't convince my doctoral board to give me a degree, a passing grade on my thesis. But maybe the tense is equally rewarding if you can simply pitch yourself as saying, I have gone down this path and I have concluded that it's probably not this way. There's a value to that too. I know you feel me. I don't know how long this is. My camera stopped a couple times in the middle of the recording, so this might be actually a gigantic episode. I apologize. Hope this was interesting. I think it's one thing to say that deep thoughts is about opening the mind. I think it's a different thing to say that deep thoughts is also galvanizing you and imbuing you with charters that are 100% yours, right? I am merely touching on your consciousness. You're an individual different than the next guy who watches this, the next girl who watches this. You're much different than me, probably. And the whole idea is that I'm trying to prod you in a direction that perhaps is your predisposition in the universe to figure something out. You know, and it doesn't have to be cosmology, and it doesn't have to be religion. You might just simply figure out something about parenting. Maybe you figure out something about the self. Maybe you figure out something just utterly esoteric, but is utterly valuable to mankind. And I hope that if you do start having these epiphanies, that you find a way to share it with the rest of the world. Somehow, a blog, tell your neighbors, tell your kids, do something, make a video, whatever, a podcast. Figure out a way to get your information out, so that we can all benefit from it. You know, I'm putting this out there because I really want the world to be a better place. And I feel like there's a lot of people doing it in their own way. This is my way of doing it. And I just find that, you know, I thought to say this much. Deep Thoughts comes out of a lifetime of having great conversations with people about these subjects. These are the kind of conversations I have with my writing mentor, with some of my best friends in life who are always trying to find something interesting that gives them a better perception of reality. And so we have these conversations over dinner for hours and hours and hours, and all I'm doing is having a one-sided version of it with you. But every time I get out of those sessions over the course of the last three decades of my life, I always come out and I go, why isn't everyone having these conversations? Is everyone? Why isn't everyone having these conversations? Like, we all love these conversations. You know, and you might get someone who's sort of deer-eyed for a little while, but I've dated people who, at first, they literally will tell me, they're like, man, you're intimidating me with your knowledge of the universe and everything. And I'm like, don't be intimidated. That's not what this is all about. I don't need you to think I'm amazing or anything for these reasons. Let's just forget my ego and forget all that crap and just go, look, you've lived as many years as I've lived, roughly. Give me your experience in this, this, and this, and this. What did you think about that when this happened to you? And I always get at the subtext of their minds, and they realize that they have a wealth of information, a well of knowledge in these areas. And sometimes the most flippant thought that they will have will be the deepest thing I've ever heard in my life. And so I'm hoping that we're sort of having that conversation with each other, even though I can't hear you, you know? So that's sort of the more of the subtext of why the show exists. So again, I'm getting a few recommendations for shows. I'm going to have to go and think about some of them and hopefully make it interesting to a wide audience, you know, but I hope these things are valuable to you. Again, it's not about me whatsoever. I just feel like I'm literally just a vessel. I sit down in front of this microphone, stuff comes into my head. I send it out to you. Sometimes I've had a lot of thought about things. Sometimes I make an episode and I listen to it afterwards to edit it, and I'm like, who was talking on this microphone? Like, I don't even remember saying half this crap. And consequently, when I think I've made the biggest stinker on planet Earth, that's when I get the most comments and accolades from the listeners. So there's something weird about that. It's almost like I felt like I wasn't present during the recording, and therefore I don't have a grasp of what I've recorded, so I feel like I created a crappy episode. But it's when I let go of what I was going to say and I just riff what's coming into my mind that the universe seems to just go right through the back of my head, through my mouth, and to you and then to me. So, I don't know. There's something about that process, but I'm trying to keep it going as long as I can, as long as I can think of subjects. But I do want to hear about your ideas, and if there's a void in your life, if anything I've mentioned in any of the episodes calls out, my God, it would be good to have a whole section about that, please tell me, because I'll do my best to put it together for you, and I'll dedicate the show directly to you. How's that, huh? If you make it this far, you're already a rare breed. You guys know where to go, mkultraradio.com. It's all there. That's all I got to say. Please like it if you like it. Please subscribe if you're into subscribing, you want to get notices of this stuff happening. We do have the podcast version if you want to listen to this in your car. I just scrape the audio off and rebalance it out. Hopefully it sounds good in your car. I do have a few episodes where the sound is awful and I apologize. I'm going to try to go back and remaster some of this stuff because sometimes it distorts and I can't stand a voice that distorts. You know, it goes too loud and it fuzzes out. So I'm going to try to get the master recordings I have off the videos and maybe rebalance them for the podcast. But I think I've conquered that problem now. I've got a really good process in place. So thanks for bearing with me through all these episodes. Again, thanks for listening. Hats off to you if you made it this far. Take care of yourself and somebody else, and we'll see you in the next episode. Over now. I was a fiend before I became a teen. I melted microphones instead of cones of ice cream. Music orientated, so when hip hop was originated, fitted like pieces of puzzles, complicated. Cause I grab the mic and try to say yes, y'all. They try to take it and say that I'm too small. Cool, cause I don't get upset. I kick a hole in the speaker, pull a plug, then I jet back to the lab without a mic to grab. So then I add all the rhymes I had, one after the other one. Then I make another one to diss the opposite, then accept the